Get ready for some more knowledge bombs. Look like you guys had a lot of questions for Ray. That's all the more reason to come out to the parties tonight and tomorrow night. You'll get to rub shoulders with our speakers a little bit more. So now that everybody has had a chance to settle down, get your cold shower in, our next presenter is, like I mentioned, my doctor. And he has saved my butt many a time when it comes to strange things that happen to my body where I have no clue what's going on and I need an expert to tell me. He is also very, very good at mitigating a lot of the stress that I place on my body and that, you know, we were just talking about toxins and pollutants and things that you get exposed to even if you're not doing something like training for an Ironman triathlon, but just living. This guy's name is Dr. Todd Schlapfer. You may have heard him a few times on the Ben Greenfield Fitness podcast. If you noticed the Life Shots formulation that was out there at the Ben Greenfield Fitness table, he played a key role in the formulation of that. And that is one of the primary ways that I protect myself against free radicals when I'm doing stuff like jumping in a chlorinated pool, et cetera. He has been nominated as the top naturopathic physician in the country. In previous years, he graduated from National College of Naturopathic Medicine down in Portland, which is one of the most prestigious naturopathic institutions in the world, and he knows his stuff. So, folks, give a warm welcome to Dr. Todd Schlapfer.
Thanks, Ben. Hello to each of you. Welcome. I feel like Ben has invited a bunch of eccentrics to the weekend, and I feel at home. Ray, good to meet you. I really appreciate that Ray has preceded me because it was a wonderful segue into what I think I will change a lot of what I'm going to say because of what he has already begun a conversation about, and I'd just like to continue that conversation. I come from a long tradition of basically what started out as thermal regulation. Basically, this was the tradition that started well over 100 years ago, and what today is known as naturopathic medicine. One of the premier aspects of that tradition has been the use of contrast bathing. And we can illumine and enlarge that conversation. I hope we do, because I think it's very significant and an overlooked, virtually ignored aspect of not just human physiology, but health. What it is that optimizes, I would say, well, let's just use the terms becoming superhuman, which to me does not mean just physically fit. It means to be fully human, to enlarge our potential in terms of what we're really capable of doing as human beings, mentally, emotionally, and physically. And the cutting edge of that is that we don't have to work so hard at it because it's intrinsic to us. A lot of what we get up to, it seems like, especially in the fitness world, is going to extremes to try and force something to happen. And unfortunately, it creates probably more damage than good. So I'm going to continue the conversation, I guess, by just giving a little background to some few thoughts that I have to say. The background is a couple patients that I just finished following up with this week. One is a patient who is severely obese and suffering from severe depression and anxiety. And the other is a patient who is now suffering from atrial fibrillation. Both of these individuals are former ultra athletes, ultra marathoners, mountain climbers, big time, devoted a lot of their younger lives to doing very, very severe exercise, and very good at it. So what they have in common is something that we as athletes have done for a long time, which is to try and go to great lengths to get to a place where we say that we're in our peak performance or peak fitness. And it hasn't turned out real well. And I, as an athlete myself and a person who considers movement and exercise to be a fundamental part of what helps me be well, I've had to, over the past 30 years of practicing medicine, take a really close look at my own life and my own advice and my own way of arranging what I would consider knowledge about how to understand who we are and how we work and how we function. So there's two facets I want to quickly cover because I want to create a lot of space for us to dialogue, to talk back and forth, questions and answers. The general piece, the first piece is just, I'm going to cover pretty quickly just the general science of what we understand about oxidative stress and exercise, the general science. And when I say that, keep in mind that general science is a method that of kind of one size fits all. It's not individuation. I really appreciate what Ray is saying with respect to, in order to learn something, we have to discover the mistakes we're making. We have to be wrong. We have to be reconnected to something that we didn't understand. The other piece is the art of learning how to design what individually works for each of us. There's an emerging science about that, but it doesn't fit the model of science that we currently use. And that is hopefully something that each of us will be able to enjoy as we go into the future. Not just as athletes, but as persons who are really trying to find the meaning in it. So, what has caught my attention over this span of time of practicing medicine is that is the relationship between extreme exercise and especially endurance sports and health. The notion and logic of more is better is not conjugating into benefit. It's not conjugating into what I would consider to be optimal health, or what being superhuman is all about. And so I really appreciate that Ben has created this forum for us to come together, counsel, and hopefully break patterns of belief and practices that really probably are not that helpful, and to evolve what could be better. Certainly being or becoming superhuman cannot exceed what is required for health and optimal function of every facet of our being, whether it's mental, emotional, or physical. Is it possible to be physically fit and not live well? Of course. That's what's motivated me to take a closer look. So to be truly fit, we must emphasize all the facets of being human, mentally, emotionally, and physically. So to be superhuman to me means to be fully human, to really discover what we're capable of doing. While exercise and athletic endeavors is being pushed to the max now, there's mounting evidence that its relationship to health has become a question heretofore overlooked. We've always known that exercise is really integral and essential for being a human being. But as Moshe Feldenkrais, I'm not sure who you know I'm speaking of, said long ago, that movement is life. Without movement, life is unthinkable. So are there boundaries, though? Are there boundaries to enhance us? Are boundaries that inhibit us, cause damage? I'm very interested in that. We know and respect that challenges, that what challenges has the potential to enlarge us, to advance us, to involve us. We know about hormesis. We know that, I mean, it's essential. It's what caused us to survive. For thousands and millions of years, death has been chasing us, and it's what's enabled us to learn how to be here, how to survive. So the emphasis of my practice as a physician is to reverse the process of illness and disease by creating pathways for optimizing function and performance. I serve numerous athletes, be they professional or coaches, and I have learned so much in doing that. Here's what I witness as a clinician. There's a certain point in an individual's biology that when demands upon it supersede its ability to recover, something happens and it's usually not good. Those two patients I just spoke about are a result of this. Disease processes take hold and undermine the pursuit of fitness, which is emblematic of health. I'm disturbed that many of us who are in pursuit of health and fitness really don't seem to get this. So it has motivated me to look really closely at what's going on here. What are the forces responsible for tilting that balance between fitness and health in a positive or negative direction? It's increasingly interesting, the dialogue that goes on with me and my friends, my athletic friends, and even my patients. So we're only at the starting line of understanding the intricacies of this, but there are some fundamental aspects that we do understand and I want to bring back into focus. Some of that is, we all know that we're endowed with this tremendous privilege to thwart what it is that threatens us. We've learned that over a long, long period of time of our evolution. We refer to it as a stress response, which is orchestrated by the immune system, which is an ever-evolving product of being chased by death. Central to that intrinsic intelligence is the ability to discern what's friendly and what's not friendly. The way we do this is very complex, but fundamental to its operation is what we call a redox equation. What holds cells together is a balance of electrons. Each of us possess this remarkable involuntary ability to protect cells and kill invasive agents. This occurs through a very intricate process of cellular signaling. The means by which oxidative stress is turned on and off. The headquarters of that, as Ray pointed out, is in the mitochondria, inside of each cell. The result is either pro-oxidation or antioxidation. This is a constant event. It's going on every millisecond of our existence. Historically, we thought that this only pertained to forces such as germs and toxins and bad food. And we considered exercise, the more the better, to yield the power to extend and defend our immune system, our ability to defend ourselves. Now we're beginning to learn there's a lot more to it, and that we can personally direct that process of oxidative stress against ourselves in realms of how we cope with stress, mentally, emotionally, and physically. So before I go any further, are we kind of all on the same page of understanding what oxidative stress is? We understand what free radical is all about? Okay? Great. So quick look at the science, the general science. And remember, the model that I'm speaking of in terms of general science is the large studies that are done with many people over long periods of time with the model of that we're all the same, right? So there's been a lot of studies that have investigated the effects of exercise or physical activity on oxidative stress. The consistent conclusion from these investigations is that intense exercise is strongly associated with increased oxidative damage, and it's dependent on other factors such as intensity or the site of the oxidative damage. However, increased production of free radicals doesn't necessarily mean a negative. It's like the contrast bathing. You do something that is insulting to the body, and the body uses this intrinsic power to overcome it and advance the ability to defend against it in the future. So there's a number of gold standard studies that have been done that has weighed in on oxidative stress. And you can see them in peer-reviewed periodicals such as the Free Radical Biology and Medicine, the International Journal of Sports, Exercise and Nutrition Metabolism, Journal of Sports Science, the Mayo Clinic Proceedings, etc. I'm not going to go into those studies. I was going to do a big PowerPoint about those, but I think we're all in a club here that has really looked at a lot of that stuff before, and I'm just going to summarize. So, fundamental findings have been that, you know, regular exercise is fundamental to our longevity. People who make exercise a part of their daily life live at least 7 years longer than our sedentary contemporaries. Exercise consumes energy, but it produces energy. This is because exercise activates our defense system and enhances that redox signaling mechanism, the glutathione pathway, and on it goes. We don't have to be conscious about any of that. It just happens. Regular training creates a positive adaptive response to oxidative stress compared to sedentary persons. but there's a point, however, where there's diminishing returns. And all of these studies are basically alike. Diminishing returns. From chronic, sustained, hardcore exercise, there's mounting evidence that can lead easily to cardiomyopathies, atrial fibrillation, cardiac scarring, diastolic dysfunction, arterial wall stiffening, hypertrophy, increased susceptibility to infections. I see that a lot. And there's a growing body of evidence that it relates to our social and relational lives, to our psyche, sleep, our hormonal milieu, gut dynamics. It's a catch-22. The patient I mentioned who has the severe obesity and severe depression and anxiety, is a really good example of that. It's also been shown that intense competition, underlying competition, upsets the balance between oxidative stress and antioxidant protection, and not for the better. Free radical-induced oxidative stress is an inevitable consequence of prolonged exercise and results in tissue damage, excessive fatigue, delayed recovery, and overtraining. How many of us have reached a point in our training where our performance is starting to diminish and we train harder to try to get it back? The studies, again, alike, combine this fact that oxidative damage seems to be more related to exercise in excess of 3,500 calories per week. In other words, modest exercise seems to get the biggest benefits, the biggest share of benefits, versus extreme exercise. That came out of a study of over 16,000 adults over a 16-year period. There's been an approximation of what modest means. Beyond 30 to 60 minutes a day has diminishing returns. Keep in mind that most of these studies are focusing on the function of the heart. Beyond 60 minutes per day, cardiovascular health seems to decrease. Many of you may remember last year the death of Micah True, who died during a 12-mile training run. He's an ultra-marathoner. He died from severe cardiac scarring and an enlarged heart. He had an arrhythmia while he was running. One study conducted by Dr. Nguyen out of Taiwan followed 14,000 adults over an 8-year period, found that 92 minutes of exercise a week produced the greatest gain of benefits. After that, not much gain. Add more 15 minutes, every 15 minutes added, not much benefit. In another study, this is of runners, 14,000 runners, was conducted by Dr. Lavie out of the John Ochsner Heart and Vascular Institute, found that the optimal amount of exercise was between 10 and 15 miles per week. Beyond that, the cardiovascular benefits diminished, much to their surprise. 70 to 80% of the benefits of exercise result from 15 to 30 minutes a day. That's what all these studies are saying. Much less than heretofore thought. Intensity seems to be more important than duration. So what's the take home on that? Increased oxygen consumption and expenditure with a very modest defense system can lead to damage. So is it possible that physical fitness may actually be in the possession of those who have much more of a modest exercise relationship? So for my patients who are in pursuit of, I would say, whole life fitness, here's what I start to emphasize. Here's what I'm doing. I slow them way down. I'm not emphasizing exercise as the doorway to go through for achieving their health. I slow them way down. I'm emphasizing intervals of intensity with longer periods of recovery. For those engaged in prolonged, intense levels of exercise, I make sure they're taking an extra load of antioxidants, cell-signaling nutrients, and a lot of B vitamins. I say things like, find the meaning in it. Learn how to do easy, light, slow, non-routine, thank you, Ray, non-routine movement. I suggest that 5 minutes maybe in the morning, every day, get up and do movement that you've never done before. It's incredible. Routine exercise, what's going to happen? The body's going to adapt to that like that. We are adaptive animals. And as soon as we adapt to something, it's not useful anymore, really. Non-routine movement. Just go crazy. You know, do things that move your body in ways that are unfamiliar to you. And it engages everything, the brain in particular. And it opens up channels of opportunity for your defense system to activate that signaling mechanism in a fresh way. So keep changing it up. I no longer encourage my patients to do heroic exercise unless it's a once-in-a-lifetime goal and it's non-competitive. Individuation. One size does not fit all. We are all a little bit different, each of us. One of the regrettable mistakes that was made with the two patients I mentioned at the beginning was that they followed a model of fitness that was not individuated to them. And they got into deep doo-doo about it. The downside of research is that one size fits all. I mean, I'm talking about the golden model, the paradigm of most science. Get a large number of people and give them the same exposure to challenges. The alignment of exercise with one's metabolic design, however, with one's genetic makeup, with one's gut dynamics, with one's climate, with the temperatures they live with their daily routine, with their job, with their relationships, makes all the difference in my world. It starts to change everything. And taking the time to flush out what's unique about each of us, how one person's food is another person's poison, why vigorous exercise for one person is an antagonist for someone else. All this plays a very determinate role in someone's oxidative stress response, their cell signaling response, that determines whether we're going to get hurt or whether we're going to be benefited. Fortunately, we're beginning to use the tools, to evolve the tools, to determine that individual uniqueness. Caloric restriction, I'm all about it. And the reason is because of hormesis. It's because when you eat less, and I should say, whole fresh food, I want to make that emphasis, then it does not become a calorie issue. It just becomes an efficiency issue. And for us to learn that and discover that, you have to do it. And it means breaking all the rules. It means going against the paradigm that we currently live in this culture. Efficiency of function is the consequence of individuation of how we move, how we eat, how we cope with stress. So fitness belongs less to how much stress we can tolerate. If health is our aim, fitness has more to do with how easily and effortlessly we move through this life. That's what brings meaning to it. After all, what are we doing it for? Why are we training? It's about right now. We're not trying to get to some point where, oh, then we'll be there. It's about now. I'm gonna stop there and hopefully enter into a dialogue with you. So let's do that. Hormesis? Hormesis is no pain, no gain. Something that challenges you, causes this central intelligence in us to be activated. A very good example is contrast bathing. I do it a little bit differently than Ray does it, but it's the same principle. I've been doing it for 30 years. And I do it every day. The way I do it personally is when I take a shower, I overheat on purpose. And the reason is so that you can set up hormesis. In other words, for this natural defense system to be activated. So you get overheated, and then you do as much contrast as possible, all the way to cold, no cheating. And you do a rinse in the cold, and you do it until that shock has passed. And you step, and you're done then. You end with cold for a reason. When you're overheating, what's happening? All the blood is coming to the surface. Your body's trying to maintain its core temperature. You get vasodilation. When you go to cold, you get vasoconstriction, of course. But as soon as you step out of the cold, what happens? What happens when you step out of a hot shower? Let's go back. Your body tries to cool off. So in order to cool off, what has to happen? Everything has to shut down, right? All those enzyme pathways are trying to cool you off. People get a chill. Maybe people get a little flu or a cold because of that. When you step out of a cold shower after being overheated, the opposite happens. There's upregulation of your circulation. There's much more oxygen efficiency. White blood cells get released because they're all stored in the gut. You warm up. You may call my name in vain when you're in the cold shower, but a minute later, it's like bliss. It's awesome. That tradition is not new. That is ancient. That is ancient. Yes? Has everything to do with what's going on internally. That's what's making sense of it, right? But there are all these other facets that play into it that are, to me, critical, like what did you eat? How much hydration? What kind of sleep are you getting? What are you wearing? And, of course, why? So all of that movement gets channeled into your internal dynamics. And that's where it either starts to make sense or you get too much information coming in too fast and your body can't handle it. And that's when confusion starts to happen.
Todd, we have a question from the pay-per-view audience.
And I did not mean to just barge into your answer. I thought
no,
you were finished right there.
Fine. That's good. And hello to you out there in virtual world.
A question on fasting. How exactly do you use that with your patients if you're going to integrate something like that for hormesis? Just like strict intermittent fasting, certain hour periods or anything of that nature?
Well, fasting is another form of hormesis. That's another way to learn how the body's efficiency can be evoked. To do fasting properly, it means to understand the individual that's wanting to fast. It would be very challenging to fast someone, for example, who is very petite and has virtually very, very low index of fat. So once there's an individuation of the gut dynamics and the body features, structures of this person who wants to fast, then we can design something that would probably be much more effective than just doing something generic. So the important thing during fasting is to maintain hydration. It's the most important piece. And enough of the trace minerals, some of which are the electrolytes that you all know about, so that there isn't starvation happening, meaning cannibalism of protein. So that's about as far as I can go with that answer, because the individual that needs to fast really needs to hook up with someone who knows how to individuate and design a fasting program for that person. Yes?
Will you discuss the difference between intermittent fasting and intermittent feeding and what might be beneficial in which case, just as an example?
Well, say more about what you're thinking about.
Well, my understanding of intermittent fasting is eating and then occasionally fasting. And intermittent feeding is fasting and occasionally eating. And so what do you see are the differences between those two for gaining health or benefiting the body?
Yeah, I love these questions. again, the degree to which there's individuation and an understanding of the dynamics of what is going on in this person's biology makes a huge difference about which choice you go to, whether it's going to be an emphasis on the fasting or an emphasis on the feeding. And then, of course, it goes beyond that. Like, okay, what are we going to use as nutrition? Again, one person's food is another person's poison. Was it you that brought up the gluten?
Yes.
So,
well, it was all grains.
Yeah.
Not just gluten.
Yeah. So one possible answer to your question, which I think the result that you had is probably very true, is that certain foods cause an inflammatory response in people. And inflammation produces heat. so when everything runs much more efficiently, body temperature starts to regulate automatically to a higher level of operation. an old way, not as old as what some of the older scientists began to learn many hundreds of years ago, but more in our century, Broda Barnes measured basal metabolic rate by using temperature in the morning at rest, in the morning, under the arm, basal thermometer, 10 minutes, what's your basal body temperature? Because it was respected that basal body temperature was a reflection of basal metabolic rate, controlled again by the upper body, the thyroid's dynamic relationship with the pituitary gland. And to this day, it's very useful. And again, it's overlooked because now people are just measuring TSH, for example, is an example of thyroid function, You can have a completely normal TSH and an abnormal metabolic rate. So understanding your thermodynamics, critical. And once you do intermittent feeding, intermittent fasting, but basically it's a relationship with food that needs to be individuated, then thermodynamics become much more easy to operate, and then everything becomes more effortless. I want to keep emphasizing that for me, the why has to do with how effortlessly I can go through my day, rather than pushing and forcing myself to try and do something that my body just is protesting against. Do you understand? Yes.
Saying there are ways it can be healthy, that there are moderate ways to still do those things.
There are moderate ways to do that once in a while, is the way I would put it. As long as you understand who you are as a body, your biology, then you can understand the way to approach it, train for it. But in general, I'm not an advocate anymore of doing it on a regular basis, and especially competitively. Well, both of those require a mindset, but yes, that. Because that is a whole other force that has to do with the cellular signaling issue, that once we understand, plays a magnificent role in what happens to our biology. It's amazing.
Yeah. Let's give Dr. Todd a hand. And the reason that he says that about endurance exercise and Ironman is because he has seen me seriously mess myself up. My memories of Dr. Todd are like meeting him in the parking lot of the coffee shop by my house with like pemmican and red wine and stuff in exchange for all these tinctures and extracts he has to dig me out of a hole and fix me when I mess myself up. So he's with Coeur d'Alene Healing Arts. For those of you who are local, I put the number for them in the program, but you know, you may want to talk to me if you're not from the area. One of the things that keeps me grounded are the occasional phone conversations that I have with Dr. Todd. He definitely brings me back down to earth, and he's a great guy. So thanks, Dr. Todd.